Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And hello, it's that time of the year again.
Well, not quite. There's a week to go.
Well, May 7th, be there, Chicago, The annual James Beard Foundation Awards for Culinary Excellence. And it's the... what do they call it? The Oscars of the food world.
Or the ACM of the food world.
Or whatever it is. Or the Grammys. It's very glamorous. Get yourself glammed out and show up. And there's a red carpet. And you'll see all of your shining stars of the culinary world. And then after the entertaining presentation of all the awards, you get to pig out, shall we say. Elegantly pig out, but there's plenty of food and drink, and it's a wonder. Lots of hugging and kissing, and everybody's there.
Sharpen your elbows.
Yes.
We used to think the New York crowd was pretty fierce, but the Chicago's
really turned out.
The city with big shoulders, and we understand why they call it the city with big shoulders at the James Beard Awards.
But it's at the Lyric Opera, which is the gorgeous building, and it's an elegance that matches the setting.
There's absolutely no doubt about that. It's a monstrously good time if you like rubbing shoulders with lots and lots of your friends and acquaintances.
And not only that, but it's a good place for people who are night owls, because when you think the events are at a certain hour, after they leave, they stop, then they go into the after parties.
Then the after parties.
There's one I saw this year, Rabbit, that starts at something or other and ends up at 4 a.m.
Yes, starts at 2, I think.
A.M. and ends up at 4 a.m.
But you need a special invite for that one. All you need to be able to go to the gala event is 5 large.
Yes.
And you can get all the information about how to do that from jbf.org.
James Beard.
Is it James Beard?
Spelled out.
JamesBeard.org.
Yes.
If you just Google James Beard 2018
Gala
Awards Gala, it'll bring you up everything you need.
Now, meanwhile, it's a very big thing for the chefs who are so honored. I want to say, by the way, that this year's Humanitarian of the Year Award is so well deserved. It's Jose Andres, who, you know, single-handedly rescued and fed Puerto Rico.
Yeah, for all his work in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, but anyhow, it's a big event for all the chefs that have struggled in their fields. It's not easy work. It may sound glamorous, or the event's glamorous, but the work in the kitchen every day is not so glamorous. But we touched base with two of the finalists to talk about what it means to them and what they're doing. And I was delighted with our first one is Claire de Burr, who, and it's actually, she's English,
the British are coming.
And her restaurant is in New York. It's King's Restaurant, New York City. And she is a...
It's not King's Family Restaurant.
It's King Restaurant. And anyhow, it's owned by three women. This had spectacular reviews, and Claire shared with us what it was like to get this nomination and what kind of things she's doing at this restaurant.
And she's nominated for one of the most competitive awards of all of them that are handed down.
Rising Star Chef, which is a national award. But we'll talk about that.
Because you only get to be eligible until you're 30 years old. So you have to do everything before 30. You better be good early.
Yep.
And then who, back to back with that, we have Zachary Gulper.
Gulper, yeah.
And Zach is actually a baker. He's in a new category. A category that...
It's not new, it's been around for a few years.
It's been four years.
Four years.
He studied it. He knew exactly how many years it had been.
He was fun, so we'll talk to him too.
He's got an amazing... Amazing, amazing life story.
We traveled a lot. Oh boy, he's lived everywhere.
Then when you get to the end, we'll give you a preview of this. When you get to the end, he finishes up in New York, and he says, "What should I do now?" And then he says to himself, well, I should open a bakery in New York. And not only did he open one, he's got three.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
So anyway, we're on the side of Claire and Zachary. We hope they emerge victorious on the night of May 7th. And if not, I'm sure they'll have a good time and they'll be back another year. So shall we play the conversation?
Yes, please.
Get on with it, Peter. Put the interviews on the air. Why don't you?
Well, I'll tell you, Claire DeBurr, you have had an interesting life background so far, and you're up for a really major award, James Beard Award for Rising Star Chef, which is the national award, and you're pitted against some pretty big talent.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had the pleasure recently of meeting a few of the people who I'm nominated with, and I think that was incredibly humbling. I met one of the nominees, Kevin, recently, and it was fantastic to see what other young people are doing, and the restaurants, to hear about the restaurants as they're opening. So it's a huge honor, and even more so, kind of getting to know some of the people who are in the same category.
Yes, and now you have a background that starts from your training in Ireland, although you yourself are English, at a place that we love, Ballymaloe. So we have good friends there with you in mind too, right?
Yeah, it's arguably one of the most fantastic places on earth, and I think a huge surprise finding such a food destination in the sleepy town of Cork.
Yes.
Yeah, and led by one of my absolute food idols, Doreena Allen, who's really pioneered the farm to table movement in Ireland, and her work with all the farmers and the students at the school she's created has left a real legacy, I'm thrilled to be a part of.
And she writes wonderful cookbooks, which are too heavy to carry.
Yeah.
Far too heavy to carry, although I have schlepped them around the world.
You have. I bet you have.
You have settled in, or resettled in. Before that, I want to mention another really important influence. In fact, we just got Ruth Rogers' cookbook.
Oh, yeah, the 30th anniversary book.
Yes. Yes, and they guarantee that these recipes work. I mean, the original one didn't work very well. you were exposed to one of the top restaurants in the world, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, growing up, my mom had the cookbooks on her shelf, and I had the privilege of going to eat there a few times for special occasions with my family. That place was a huge inspiration for me to even go into the kitchen. It's a spectacular and very special place where the menu changes every day, and they really work with the most incredible ingredients. And they've also got an open kitchen, and, Ruth Rogers takes incredible care of her staff. Having eaten there and seen what they do, it was a huge inspiration for me to kind of want to get into the kitchen. And I think that Ruth Rogers is one of the trailblazers in the industry for women. She sets an incredible example of what it means to run and own a business and to cook food that is really evocative of these places, but also with a sort of a sense of personal flair.
She already has two generations of disciples who've been through there, herself.
She's been doing it for 30 years. And, you look around at the list of people that have kind of gone through her kitchen, and it's they're doing incredible things, but she also manages to hold on to some of the very best cooks I've met. So you might not know their names, but there are some true stars in the kitchen there.
Now, you met Jess Shadbolt in Ireland when you were studying?
No, we were one semester apart, actually.
Oh.
So we met at the River Cafe. Yeah, she went to the River Cafe, and then I went to the River Cafe. So we met on the Coles line, nibbling prosciutto, together.
And then you have, Annie Shy?
Annie Shy.
And so you then formed a trio of women that opened a restaurant called, of all things, King.
Yep.
Why is King a good name for a women's restaurant?
Yeah, it ought to be called, at the very least, it ought to be called Queen.
We'll have a quite a simple answer, and we're situated on King Street.
Right, right.
So I think, you know, people keep naming us all sorts, like the Queens of King, and it wasn't a play on the fact that we're three women. It was merely kind of, we just wanted to honor the place where we're located.
So now you bring all of your various interests to bear at this restaurant, which has a daily changing menu. Your interest is farm to table or whatever anybody wants to call it. And it seems to me with southern France and Italy that it's a Mediterranean influence.
Yeah, very, very much. We cook the food that we've kind of eaten on our travels and worked with a cafe. And I think there's also a little bit of an English influence that kind of sneaks in now and again. You know, we have on Sundays we serve crumbles, and it's not quite a Sunday lunch like it is at home. But I think the ethos behind the whole thing is very kind of authentic to all of our backgrounds.
What's on the menu tonight?
Well, I'm not actually in the restaurant, but I can have a guess based on what I ordered yesterday.
There you go. I'm sure you know.
We've got some amazing wild red snapper that's coming in off the East Coast at the moment. And they're like 8-pounders, so we're going to be baking the whole fish in salt and stuffing the bellies with wild fennel fronds. I'm probably serving that with something very simple, like a tapenade. And also, we've just got the very first spring peas and their shoots. So I imagine there'll be something like a vignole, like a spring stew with artichokes, fava's, and those peas. And given the fact the sun is shining, I'm sure we'll have a selection of semifreddos on the menu. Probably a lemon and vermouth semifreddo for dessert, and if you're lucky, a creme caramel.
Well, it's pretending to be spring at any rate.
Hasn't been spring around here yet. I don't even have my pea seeds in yet.
No, the gardener hasn't even showed up.
It's definitely spring for the next few hours in New York City, I'd say.
Okay, got it.
So how does this all translate into New York? You're in what part of New York are you?
We're in Manhattan, and the restaurant's in West Soho. And the three of us met in London, but Annie, our partner, is from here. And the first day I met her, we went out for dinner together, and we decided that we would very foolishly open a restaurant in Manhattan, and we kind of didn't look back. We very, very quickly left both of our jobs, and moved over here, opened our laptops, and Googled how to open a restaurant in New York. So, yeah, it all happened quite quickly, and New York's been incredible. Everyone here is obsessed with food, and eats out incredibly regularly, so we've been the benefactor of so much enthusiasm in food here, and the community, especially in kind of lower Manhattan, is so vibrant, and everyone's been very supportive, despite the fact that we were kind of outsiders coming in with relatively little experience.
Well, of course, there are lots of outsiders in New York. It's, you know.
Well, what was it that Paul Revere said on his, before jumping on his horse? The British are coming, the British are coming.
That's not something you hear a lot in this city, I would say.
Well, I'm proud of you anyway. I don't care what they say.
Well, anyhow, all our congratulations on your finalist status, and much success. And hopefully we'll see you in Chicago.
Absolutely. We'll be there, ready to have a great time.
Well, you will. Have you been before?
I have been to Chicago. I went when I was quite young and, you know, took lots of pictures standing in front of the Bean. But we've got our itinerary cut out for us. We're going to be visiting a friend of ours' restaurant called Michokaya, and that I'm sure is going to be one of the highlights, as well as all the awards ceremony.
So, what is the restaurant?
Michokaya. It's run and owned by a woman called Diana.
Oh yeah.
And I think she was a semi finalist, and we recently met her, and she was huge. I mean, she's an absolute force, and I just can't wait to eat her food.
Oh, well, that sounds great.
If you want to try someone entirely different, there's a restaurant called Fat Rice.
Oh yeah, that's fun.
Which is food from Macau.
Oh.
Yeah, that's okay, just good.
Well, if that's what you're recommending, I'll be sure to.
Oh, well, no, I mean, there's so many.
There are lots of them. Yeah. I mentioned it only because it's rather unusual, being that the cuisine is from
Macau.
Although the owners are American.
Yeah, the husband and wife.
Definitely something I haven't tried before.
That's why I thought I might suggest it. But you'll find lots of there are lots of places. You will not be hungry.
Yeah, and Alinea just got a first outstanding restaurant by some listicle maker. I can't remember what it is. So, and you won't get in there probably. it's hard. Everybody descends on Chicago at this one moment in time. Yeah. Well, you have a good time, and hopefully we'll see you. Come visit us in the press room.
And we'll
absolutely.
Once again, we wish you all the best. We hope you come back a winner.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure nice meeting you, Claire.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
We just realized that we should have explained that at this stage of the contest for the James Beard Awards, we have finalists, but the finalists don't get resolved to the one person who won until the night of the awards themselves. So although we think Claire has a very good chance, and we think Zach has a very good chance. They are at this point one of six or seven in each in their categories. And having explained that, let's take a break, and then we'll be right back with the final segment of the program. Now, Zach Gulper is a baker, but I'm thinking of him more like the Bob Dylan song, "Like a Rolling Stone." Because you've rolled your stone quite a lot of places since you were born in Portland, Oregon. We just found out you lived for a while in London. We know you were in Philadelphia. We know you're now in New York with two bakeries.
Three
bakeries.
It?
Three now. My goodness. But we're talking to you today because you're close to laying claim to being one of the very best. Perhaps you can tell us the excitement you experienced when you found out that not for the first time you've been nominated for a James Beard Award, and what it is.
Well, it's an extraordinary honor. In the beginning, I wasn't sure really how to react to it because I... No, is this easier for you? When I first received the nomination, it was... It was an extraordinary feeling. I really didn't know how to react to that because many of the other people on the list were the people that were not necessarily my mentors, but the people that I had looked up to for years and years as some of the greatest in the industry. And the fact that they put me in the same list with those people I didn't know how to react to it. Just, it was an honor. And then when I finally got out to Chicago and I'm, you know, rubbing elbows with some of the people that have been, you know, legends in my mind, some of the greatest in cuisine in the United States, and there they are, you know, having a few too many drinks and hanging out with me. it was amazing. And at the same time, it felt normal. Once I, you know, let go of my anxiety for being there amongst these people, then I realized everybody's just a person, and the people who are the greatest are, they got there through hard work. And that's something that we all share, that none of this was just handed to anybody. Everybody that is up there that's on that list, they're all deserve it, in my opinion. And so to have that feeling and then reflect on it and think, well, I guess that means that I am too, it's just a tremendous honor. It's very hard to put words to it.
Yeah, we had one chef. I think it was Gabe Kreuter from The Modern.
Gabe.
He called his mother at like 2 o'clock in the morning to let her know that he'd won, and she didn't believe him.
she said, "You've been drinking.
Yes.
Go to bed."
Something like that.
Now, tell us, how did you end up baking? Period, and especially bread.
Well, that was it was incidental, not intentional. In the beginning, I had started cooking, and then I didn't really feel like I knew the source of food very well. So I work on a farm, and when I went to go work on this organic farm, I spent time with the trees and the plants and the seasons and the soil. And while I was there, there was a guy who was baking every 3 or 4 days. And my window to my room was upwind of the flue of the oven.
Oh, wow.
So I would smell the roasted grain and sourdough aroma coming through my window, and it drew me out of bed eventually, and I asked him if I could learn how to do what he's doing, and he said, well, I guess so. You know, he was reluctant, but he let me learn, he let me do it with him, and I didn't realize that would be a career move. I just thought it was knowledge that I wanted to have. And then as time went on, I developed more and more of an attraction to pastry and bread, and eventually was down in South America for a couple years.
Where?
One thing that drew me back to North America and Western Europe was bread, because down in South America at that point in time, there was no good bread that I could find.
Yeah. Tell me
and
where.
So I decided I'd turn around and come back just because I need to have this stuff in my belly and in the cells of my body. It's part of me.
Where in South America were you?
Oh, gosh, I did Colombia, the entire Pacific coast. I did Colombia, Ecuador, Bolivia, Peru, Chile, Argentina, and then, of course, all of Central America and Mexico.
Wow, you are a rolling stone.
See, listen, yeah, he's a rolling stone. Let's sing it, huh?
So,
well,
now,
let me say, they've got really good tortillas down there.
Yeah, okay. They do.
But the bread's no good.
The bread's not good.
No, they're getting better, though. Didier Rosado went down there maybe 15 years ago or so, and I think he frequently goes back and did some courses on slow fermentation. And I was down there just this last year, went down to Chile to visit some people, and there have been maybe 4 pretty good bakeries that have opened up and are starting to practice slow fermentation and natural leavening. And for me, it was revolutionary to see that happening in a place where just 20 years ago they were serving hockey pucks and calling it bread.
Well, you know, we lived in Washington, D.C., and we had the Argentinian bakery in Georgetown, and I had their baking schedule posted in my kitchen so I could go and get hot croissant and hot, you know, and things right out of the oven. But they were French. The Argentinian bakery was really French.
Yeah, the Argentinian experience is, I think, probably the most European of all of South America that I've experienced.
Uh-huh. Right. Now, how did you get from, among other things you did, helping George Perrier with his bread program at Lebec Fan in Philadelphia? You took a giant step somewhere right after that. You took a giant step and opened your own bakery. Tell us about that.
Well, I would say that it was all a progression. And I definitely had lady luck on my side. You know, when I came back to the United States, I worked with Greg Mistel and Tim Haley out in Portland, Oregon. Then was offered a job by William Lehman up in Seattle, who, you know, these are 3 tremendously talented people. And then offered a job by Jean-Claude Canestrier in Vegas to open a hotel. And doing all these things led me to, you know, the opportunity to work for Georges Perrier, and then from Georges Perrier, learning how he perceives food and understands balance and flavor and fat, salt, and acidity, and it took it to the next level. I had, you know, chocolate, I had cake, I had bread, and I had a lot of time to experiment while I was in Vegas, but then working with George, he showed me things that you can do with cream that I didn't know was possible. He showed me emulsification techniques that you can do using simply a whisk. He was so brilliant, and I felt like all the people that I had worked for were just tremendously talented, that, you know, you add that into my own personal drive to try to continue to challenge myself, it just made sense. Either I was going to come to New York and open, work for somebody who was running a nice program, or I was going to, you know, throw it all out there and work for myself. And I decided to do that. And my wife, she said, well, what do you think is going to sell? And I said, well, baguettes and croissants. And she goes, no, really, what do you think's going to sell? And I said, no, really, baguettes and croissants. And she thought it was funny because I'd created this very elaborate menu with the utilization of rare cheeses and, you know, interesting products. And in the end, it's still a bakery, and we sell baguette and croissants.
Yeah. It's called Bien Cui.
Bien Cui.
And it means?
Oh, that means well done in French, in the reference of like a, if you were to cook a steak, well done. So it's the darkly baked baguettes. And the reason I named it that was while I was in France staging at a little patisserie, in the evenings we would go, he would send us home, and I would always pick up a bread from the bakery that I liked. I found the one in the village that I liked the most, and I kept asking for it to be darker or more brown, until finally my ear heard what the other people were asking for, and they wanted the same thing, and they would say, je voudrais un baguette bien cuit, and I was like, oh, that's it, bien cuit. So that always stuck, because it's what I like, it's how I like to eat, and it just seemed like a good name for a bakery.
It does, yes.
Now here's a question, but what do you think when Mario Batali buys your bread and then he burns it?
Mario Batali burns my bread?
I guess he's not doing that anymore, but that's how he used to serve his bread in our
there are two things that get Peter really upset. One is this, that European thing that Batali does where he burns the bread on purpose. And the second thing is not putting any salt in it in Florence and Tuscany.
That was you.
I think on a gastronomic level, Batali has done wonders for the United States. And, I know he may have put himself into a bit of a pickle, but he is also a tremendous talent. And when he brings some of these concepts to the U.S., I think there's some real energy behind it and some history. And I know that the Tuscan saltless bread is, they made that because it ferments very quickly without the sodium to control the bacteria and the yeast. And then they've got this bread that also stales very quickly. So they make a kind of a stew, I guess it is, that's called Ribollita.
Yeah, we love
it. That is just phenomenal.
Yeah, we love it. But why the burnt stuff? I never did find out about that.
Yeah, I'm not familiar. I know some people are starting to put charcoal.
Yeah, just charcoal and everything.
Charcoal croissant. That's a little nutso to me, but
Everything's black now, you know.
Well, who's the guy in San Francisco who
Roberts
who burns his bread?
Oh, I don't know.
And then the restaurant, they take his burnt bread and grind it up and make a powder out of it, and then they use that in their cooking.
Oh, that's the you know we're talking about the she's wonderful. She just went to New York, actually.
Are they doing it intentionally, or is it a concept?
No, they're using a burnt toast as a flavoring, even an ice cream.
Okay.
Chad Robertson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I know that many years ago, over at Corton, they were making a toast ice cream. That was maybe 7 years ago. That was utterly delicious. So if it tastes anything like that, then it's worth eating.
Now, I wanted to ask you, in passing, you mentioned a slow, long fermentation. Now, is that your bake? I said we'd talk about baking thoughts, and I mean, I don't want to get too technical, but that seems to be on trend at the moment, for pizza and bread.
I certainly hope it stays on trend. It makes food more digestible, and it's the way that human beings have been making bread for thousands of years.
And how long are you talking? How long? What's long?
Oh, long fermentation. Well, that I believe that's always relative to where you live and what the season is. But in the case of controlled fermentation, where you're using a refrigerator, in our case, long fermentation means 3 days for a sourdough, and our croissant actually takes close to 96 hours to make.
Wow.
96 hours, really?
Yeah, it's the process. I could take you through it, but it's a little long-winded to talk about it. It's easier to see it if you come visit the bakery. But the the people who are doing really great whiskeys and you know, distillates of various sorts are doing oftentimes a 4-day fermentation or longer to maximize what they're getting from the barley or the rye that they're using. And so it's funny that people have been drinking great whiskey for you know, centuries, and the concept of doing slow fermentation with the bread somehow seems new, yet it's how people have been fermenting grains forever, for the last 10,000 years.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I mean, if it's in the results, I mean, I've always loved the this long, slow fermented product, so I guess,
yeah. Yeah. I first had...
And I like the whiskey, too.
I'm sorry, say again, please?
I said, and I like the whiskey, too.
Yes, yeah, I probably like that a little too much myself. the first time I ever tried really beautiful sourdough, I mean, I'd had, you know, various different people's rendition, but something that was steadily made and out of a bakery that was reputable was in France, a place called Poilane, which many people are familiar with. Uh-huh. But it was sort of mind-changing to me that people were no longer looking for this giant open crumb, that this bakery in France was making this dense, huge loaf of bread that was delicious. Mm. And that experience was kind of wonderful, because in the United States at that time, a lot of bakers, artisan bakers, were trying to make wide open crumb breads that were very, very high hydration, and they looked kind of, you know, beautiful in that way, with the big holes, but they lacked a lot of flavor. And so it was nice to me to see somebody that didn't care at all about that and was just doing
well. It also tears when you're trying to butter it.
Yeah, and to use oil, the oil drips through.
The oil goes through, yeah. Well, you know, maybe at the Beards we'll have some time to talk some more about your ideas. And I'm glad you enjoy them and enjoy Chicago. So, and you need to get on the circuit for the 50 best restaurants, too. That's a lot of fun.
That would be fun. I don't know if a bakery's ever going to make its way in there,
I doubt that. But anyway, listen, we wish you the very best. We hope you come home a winner this time. And who knows?
Yeah, Zach, this is your turn, isn't it?
We'll see. We'll see. There's some really great competitors out there, and I wish us all the best of luck.
Yeah,
thank
you know,
you so
I mean,
much for having me on.
It's a new category. I mean, it for the last few years, really. I mean, it's never traditionally it was not a category. So,
yeah, I think this is the fourth year. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. Again, we're all rooting for Zach Gulper and for outstanding baker.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and hope to see you in Chicago.
I look forward to it. We'll tip a glass together.
Thank you,
Zach.
Have
a good one.
Bye bye.
All right. Take care.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, finishing out today's program, Beyond James Beard Awards and so on and so on and so on, we have...
If you're in the mood,
you want to know where all the chefs eat. One of the biggest books you ever seen in your whole life.
Actually, Joshua David Stein is the editor
The Americas.
Of the Americas, both North and South.
Yeah, our friend Joe Warwick was one of the founders.
Exactly.
And he's still involved. And I remember we asked him, Joe, when we talked to him, and then just through the first one, we said, how are you going to keep it up to date? He said, we're going to keep it up to date.
Yeah, and there's also an app with it. You can take it with you, the app.
Yep, but that's true. But David did say that they're going to update the app on the same timetable as the book.
Well, why don't we let Joshua David Stein
explain
the whole thing to us. He does a good job.
He sure does.
Diligently on this book. And
diligently.
Here he is.
There's a $5 word if you like.
Diligently.
Diligently.
Good. Okay.
Diligently where chefs eat. Hello, Joshua.
Hello.
This is Peter. Go.
You know what?
Go ahead and do that intro again.
Okay. My name is Joshua David Stein. I'm the North America and South America editor of the third edition of Where Chefs Eat, a guide to chefs' favorite restaurants, which came out April 4th.
And this is one of the biggest books in the Western world.
Well, it's thick, not large.
Thinking back, the book that I can think of that it most resembles is the good old A to Z map of London.
Bible.
The Holy Bible is probably slightly bigger. But this is a major undertaking, and the first time we talked to someone about this book called Where Chefs Eat, we talked to Joe Warwick, who was another of the guys who now works on it, and who says he was the inventor of it. Whether he was, I don't know, but it certainly seemed like a major idea. And we said, Joe, how are you going to keep this up to date? So, first of all, Joshua, tell us, our listeners, some more about how the book is organized, and then let's go on and talk about the process of making sure it's kept up to date.
Well, can I first just give you some numbers? We're talking here 4,500 places to eat listed, over 650 chefs contributing to this, and of course, Peter already told you it probably weighs how many pounds, Joshua?
How many pounds? I don't know.
10.
I would say it's a pound and a halfer.
Yeah, the print's pretty small.
Maybe a little more.
Yeah. The print's pretty small.
Yeah, and the pages are really thin, and the print's really small.
We have had heavier books like Thomas Keller's books coming at 5 pounds plus.
Well, the guy in New Orleans, what's his name?
John Falls.
John Falls's books.
John Falls gets the biggest ones.
Yeah, I think they're like 10 pounds or something.
Well, I feel like they have glossier pages. This is printed on newsprint.
There you go.
Yeah.
Anyway, so. The project. Describe the project and the book.
Sure. Well, the whole idea of Where Chefs Eat, which was developed by Joe and the editors at Sidon, was to harness the taste and the experience of chefs from around the world around where they like to eat, divided into 8 categories. And the categories that we ask the chefs are restaurants that are worth the travel, they're go-to breakfast place, their local favorite, the restaurant they wish they'd opened, their favorite late-night restaurant, a regular neighborhood restaurant, a bargain or cheap eats choice, and a high-end restaurant. So Joe's obviously based in the UK, and in previous editions, I think everyone felt that the North America and South America could use a little more representation. So for the third edition, they brought me on to head up that project. The way that I approached it was I wanted to obviously pay respect and heed to the major cities that we need to cover and want to cover, but also to maybe the smaller cities, which if you're not immersed in the food world in the States, you might not notice, or you might not think to cover, I guess.
Like what, for example?
Baltimore, Charlotte, Detroit, Indianapolis, Maui.
Probably Phoenix, Pittsburgh, too.
Pittsburgh, San Antonio. You know, there's 84 new U.S. locations in the third edition.
Oh, that's good to know. Yeah.
Yeah.
How about the chefs? Were they already given to you, or did you get to pick new ones?
There was a mix. Obviously, I picked a lot of new ones to sort of get the picks in that area. The way that we put the book together is I would identify chefs in whatever city and then reach out to them and ask them for 8 recommendations. So if there were 10 chefs that responded, then if there's no overlap, that's obviously 80 restaurants in the city. So it's a very fast way to get deeply connected into a city's culinary landscape.
So you and your colleague who does Latin America, I guess South America, you were added to the team.
I did Latin and South America as well.
Okay, but you have a colleague now, right?
But my colleagues did Europe was Joe.
Oh, okay.
Asia was Evelyn, and Australia was Natasha.
Okay, got it. I got it up
by territory.
I got them mixed up there.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have all these sections in the book. I might question how in the world anybody's going to travel with this thing. You know, it's very awkward. And it's an eye test. But are we supposed to be able to travel with it? How are you supposed to use it? Go through it before you go anywhere or what?
You can. It's a book, so you can use it however you want. You can either look up the city where you're about to go and then copy down some restaurants so you don't have to carry the whole book. You can download the app at wherechefsy.com, which has all the information. And
oh, so everything
your phone.
So everything is online?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay.
Or what I do, although maybe I'm an outlier because I wrote the thing, is just reading through it is actually just as putting it together was interesting. Reading so many cities, not just in the States, obviously, but around the world.
Yes, some of the chefs were really very, very helpful. And it's interesting. At the beginning, you actually have a listing of who the chefs are and which were their recommendations. So for example, if you want to find out where Massimo Bottura from Osteria Francescana in Modena, Italy, where he likes to eat, you can find him right there. It's quite amazing.
I think that goes to your question a little of how to use it. You can either use it by city or you can use it by chef.
Yeah.
Yeah. The reason, one of the many reasons we have their little bios to begin with is because the chefs weren't compensated in any way for taking the time out of their schedules to do this. So we thought the least that we could do was to also, not only for them, to give them exposure. I mean, like a guy like Massimo doesn't need more exposure, but to honor their contribution to the bio in the beginning, and also part of our jobs as editors was to find the most interesting chefs and ask them to contribute. So we wanted, of course, to shout their names from the rooftops as well.
Now, most of Massimo's are high-end restaurants. Am I wrong? I thought that in the original Where Chefs Eat, there was a little section of secret finds. Is that in this one?
There is. It's still there. I mean, whether it's secret finds, I'm not sure. But there are a lot of restaurants in that class that are there, places you'd never have heard of.
Where are they?
You'd never have heard of otherwise. Well, you find them in the section where it's listed by chef.
Yeah, I mean, so like I said, there's eight different genres, and maybe that's a regular neighborhood place or a local favorite falls more into that category.
Okay, all right.
Now there are a couple of other indexes as well, though, right? So there's a geographical index, which goes by country alphabetically.
And then cities within the country, yeah.
And then cities within the country alphabetically.
And then there's also regions in the cases where there's not enough restaurants to devote an entire section to a city.
Got
so
it.
That would be okay. Like USA West or something like that.
You mean there aren't enough good restaurants in USA West?
Some people might argue with you there. USA West doesn't include San Francisco or L.A.
Right.
Because those are broken up.
Got it. Now, back to my earlier question. The biggest challenge, surely, is keeping this up to date. How do you go about that?
Keeping it up to date? Well,
yes.
I think we're probably going to start work on the next one pretty soon. This is a third edition, and I think we'll keep on doing new editions. I mean, the concern about keeping things up to date is somewhat mitigated by the fact that there are more than 4,500 restaurants around the world. So even if a few of them go out of business between editions, the vast majority of them won't. Of course, we check before it goes to print to make sure the restaurants recommended are open and operational.
Yeah,
at the same time, we always suggest that our readers call ahead to make sure, or look at the website or do whatever you need to do, do your own due diligence to make sure that the places are still open.
Yeah, and by the way, listeners, in the detail section, that information is there. So you don't have to carry a whole pocket full of business cards as long as you have a space to put the book. I actually ran a check just for the hell of it, accidentally thinking about the fact that a very favorite chef of ours in London, who was the chef at Fino and then the chef at the Barrafinas, the several of them, and she and a partner just opened a new restaurant called Sabor, S-A-B-O-R, and sure enough, it's in there.
Uh-huh.
There you go.
We knew
you were going to look.
Well, I have a feeling you must have put it in there before it actually opened, finally, because it didn't open until back about 6 weeks ago.
Yeah, I think, well, so the other thing just to mention is it's not just that there are the details of the restaurant. We try, where chefs had particularly insightful quotes or something that we thought our reader should know, we included that in the restaurant write-up. And then I and the rest of the team wrote short reviews to really give the readers a taste of restaurants. And that's kind of why I was saying that even if you're not traveling in the moment, it's a good read in the sense that you get to taste of a bunch of different restaurants.
Right. How do you check on these? Let's do this. From now, when you're starting the next revised edition, how long before it comes out? What kind of lead time do you have in publication?
I'm not sure because I'm a writer, but I'm not part of FIDEN. We actually haven't, thank God, started to dig in again. The book just came out, I think, 2 days ago.
Uh-huh.
But I'm sure the series, as a series, obviously we're interested in multiple editions to keep it up to date, also to include new chefs and to adequately and appropriately reflect the evolution of varying cities' culinary scenes.
Now, are you updating the online app at the same time? Because that you can do every day, right? Every time you get a new piece of information.
From my understanding, I don't think the app is going to be updated on a rolling basis.
Oh, okay.
I think just from a logistical standpoint, that becomes like someone's full-time job.
Yeah, I guess I'm interested in how the editors experience the restaurants. Do you go to these restaurants?
Obviously I've gone to most of them in New York. I haven't gone to the other restaurants, or, you know, I've probably gone to some of them, but my going to a restaurant wasn't a criteria for its inclusion. The whole premise of the book is that we trust the chefs.
Okay.
So it's being filtered through their taste level, which generally, I think,
and
we
if
think
it's
is
not
high.
Liked as represented, you can blame the chef.
Yes, and then we can always just blame them. And then it's plausible deniability, so you can blame the chef.
Exactly.
Chefs are certainly better than Yelpers.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe.
I think so.
Well, the thing about chefs is that they work incredibly hard. They work usually 6 days a week. A lot of them have families. Maybe, you know, some of them don't, but a lot of them do. And so if they're going out to eat, they really care about where they're going. There's no throwaway meals for a chef. I used to be a restaurant critic, so I would eat out all the time. Now I have, you know, two kids, and I try not to go out very much at all so I could be home with them. But that means when I go out, I really care so much about where I'm going. You know, I really want it to be a good experience.
Chefs that I know, when they go out, they eat junk food. They eat really crappy places.
Well,
hopefully well, we didn't talk to any of the chefs you know.
Be sure to ask them before you include them. Ask them if they know Anne Haig. And you can drop them.
Where
on
are you
the
guys
spot.
Based?
We're in Pittsburgh, but we're internet based, is what the show is. But I did do City Mag. I was a restaurant critic too. And the thing about the updating, I had a 2-month lead, and sometimes I'd do a review, and by the time the fact checker got there, the restaurant was already closed. It was such a volatile industry.
You had one.
You had a 10-month lead?
2 months.
Two-month
lead.
Oh, two. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, but sometimes the restaurants were already closed by the time the fact checker got there.
Yeah, I mean there's a lot of turnover, but I do think that the fact that these are restaurants which have been, the idea isn't that these are the newest restaurants. This is that they're the best restaurants for whatever the category is, and that sort of hopefully makes it less likely that they'll be gone in, you know, that they'll be not long for this life.
Right.
No, I'm with you. I mean, I think if you're looking for who's going to have the most up to date feel for how a restaurant is, especially one that they like, then it's going to be the chef, because there's a mafia among chefs as to, you know, who's still in business and who's not, and who's still cooking the way they used to and who's not. I mean, I think that's somewhat reliable. My partner in crime is staring at me saying, she doesn't agree, but that's all right.
Some of the best restaurants in town, the best chefs, they go out, they're looking for a cheap Chinese or a taco place. I mean, they're the ones to put David Chang on the map, actually, because of his late night stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, so a lot of the late night and cheap eat restaurants actually were taco shops or like noodle houses. So it's definitely true that I think, especially fine dining chefs, they don't want to mess with fine.
Right.
They don't want to mess with fine dining.
That's for sure.
You know, at 11 or 12 p.m. when they get off their shift.
Exactly. Well, you have. Are you totally immersed in all this now?
Am I immersed in it? No.
No.
I mean, I know it.
But do you get to do anything else?
Yeah, I mean, I do a lot of other stuff. I'm the editor at large, and I'm actually speaking to you from the office of Fatherly, which is a website devoted to modern parenting. And I have my own podcast with them called The Fatherly Podcast.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So I do a lot of non-food stuff, which I'm, you know, I wrote about restaurants and food for a long time and travel, and I kind of got tired of it.
Yes.
So I'm very, and also, you know, having a family, it's not that fun, because you go out and you have these great meals at a restaurant, and then you come home and your kids are asleep and you didn't get to hang out with them, and you don't have anyone really to share that experience with. I mean, you have friends, but they're not your family.
Now that I write about fatherhood, I
write about my relationship with them, and just as I was so into restaurants, now I'm so into my kids.
Uh-huh. You know. How many do you have?
I have two. They're 4.5 and 6.
Oh, wow. Nice ages, too. Yeah.
I do, you know, I still write for the Village Voice. Every other week I have a column called The Trencherman, which is about restaurants. And I have two kids' books that came out about food. One's called Can I Eat That? And one's called What's Cooking?
Uh-huh. What age group are they for?
4 to 7.
Uh-huh. Good. Our kids are gone for that.
You'll have to write some more coming up, right? Because the kids will need more.
Yes. I have to write a book called Where Kids Eat.
Where Kids Don't Eat. That's not too far off, you know. I mean, they're really interested into fine dining anymore. It's amazing. Children's menus, of course, pushed by adults, are becoming very fancy.
Well, yeah, I mean, in a lot of, I think one of the things that I've been happy to see, at least in a couple of restaurants where I live in Brooklyn, is there aren't really kids' menus anymore. What they do, there's a place I'm thinking of in particular called Camperdown Elm. And what they do is they take certain elements from some of the dishes for adults and kind of create a kid's dish from them.
Oh, great.
And I thought that was great because, you know, when I take my boys out, I don't, you know, they're picky. Well, one of them, Achilles, is a picky eater, but I want them to be part of the experience, you know? I don't want them to have subpar food.
You know why the kid's picky? You named
Do
him Achilles.
Yeah.
Achilles. Achilles heel, right?
Achilles was not known primarily for being a picky eater. He was known for an oversight on his mom's part.
Well, Joshua, we thank you so much for taking the time.
And Joshua, you talk about literary giants. Your name, you have to become one. It's absolutely it's a literary giant's name if I ever heard one.
And next,
Joshua David Stein.
And next time you talk to Joe Warwick,
tell him we said hello.
Remind him. We met him a couple of years ago.
And Peter, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Oh, it's fun talking to you, Joshua. Okay.
Bye.
And good luck with this book.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, sweetheart, is that a wrap for today?
It is indeed.
And what do we say?
Bye-bye.